The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Miku, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. The first part of our program today, we're going to bring you another one of our Urbanite radio stories. In our partnership with Urbanite magazine, we take the stories at Urbanite that you can read in the Urbanite, and we turn them into conversations and radio. And there was a really fascinating article in the issue of Urbanite, in the March issue, this issue right now. It was a conversation with Chuck Schmitz. Chuck Schmitz is Associate Professor of Geography at Towson University. He's president of the American Institute for Yemeni Studies. He served as the Arabic translator and cultural interpreter for detainee Salim Ahmed Hamdan. You remember that name at Guantanamo Prison, one of the most famous cases that America knows about that came out of Guantanamo. You can read about him in this month's Urbanite magazine in an article called Lost in Translation. I'll remind you now that this month Urbanite unveils the Urbanite Project, its third annual experiment in the power of unconventional collaboration. And Urbanite is available in print at more than 800 locations around the Baltimore region and online at urbanitebaltimore.com. And right now we're going to talk with Chuck Schmitz. You can join us here at 410-319-8888 as we explore his world of Yemeni culture and what he did with Salim Ahmed Hamdan. And welcome, Chuck. Good to have you with us.
Having me.
I've been looking forward to this conversation with you. The article is called Lost in Translation. And so, first of all, you were talking before we went on the air that America has a real dearth of Arabic scholars, Arabic speakers, and what people call Arabists. People understand the Arab world and its language, and you're one of those people.
Yeah, Mark. It's difficult. Arabic is a difficult language. It takes, you know, more years to gain fluency and quite a bit more work than say the Romance languages. So that's one part that's difficult. And the Arab world is not easy to do research in as well. You know, there's repressive governments. It's dangerous sometimes. And so it puts a brake on scholarship. It puts a brake on people going over there.
And your particular area was it was Yemeni culture and Yemen.
That's right.
A country that's right on the south, I guess, the west, east coast of what is Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, the tip of the Arabian Peninsula.
Right.
Right across the straits from Djibouti and from Somalia. Yeah.
Which is where some of bin Laden's family comes from.
Yes. That's one of the things that the country is famous for. The ancestral homeland of Osama bin Laden. Yes, that's right. His father was Yemeni from the Hadramaut region, and he went to work for the king of Saudi Arabia in the 20s and 30s.
But it's clearly a very different culture than Saudi Arabia.
The Yemeni culture?
Yes.
Actually, a section of Yemen was taken by the Saudis in a war in 1934. And so there's the southern section of Saudi Arabia is actually very culturally Yemeni. But the Saudi culture of the desert, the Bedou, the Saudi tribes, that's a very different culture, yes.
So here you are, you're a professor at Towson University, and you speak fluent Arabic in a number of dialects, and you said the dialects in Arabic can make one dialect does not necessarily understand the other dialect in Arabic.
That's right. That's one of the things that makes it difficult.
And you understand and speak a number of dialects, especially from Yemen in Arabic.
Yeah, that's right.
So here you are, professor of geography, and going your merry way and doing your research and teaching students and writing your tracks, and you get a call from a lieutenant commander in the United States Navy, Charlie Swift, to ask you to come translate for one of the prisoners in Guantanamo that he's representing in court.
That's right. Charlie's quite a guy. And he called me up, and I said, no. I said, you're crazy. You know? Yeah, no. I didn't want to be involved in any kangaroo courts. You know, there was only guilty verdicts down there. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know Charlie. I didn't know what he was about. And no, I didn't want to become involved in that. But, you know, Charlie's a very persuasive guy. He's a lawyer. He's a good lawyer. He's a defense attorney. And he's got quite the capacity to persuade. Basically, he talked my ear off, and I surrendered, and I said, okay, I'll go down with you. And, you know, eventually I came to see that he was serious and that the defense attorneys that had been appointed by the Department of Defense to defend the detainees were serious. And they really meant to defend. They really meant to attack the system as well. But it took a while before I realized that, you know.
So what convinced you to do this? I mean, you are clearly have a sensitivity to Arabic, to Arab-speaking people and to Arabs and to Yemeni people in particular. You speak the language. You know the culture. You spend time in Yemen. And Salim Ahmed Hamdan was accused of being the driver for Osama bin Laden and a dangerous conspirator against America.
Right. Well, he was one of bin Laden's drivers. He was accused of conspiracy initially in the Bush 1 tribunal system. And then he was charged with material support and conspiracy in the MCA, the Military Commissions Act of Congress in 2006. And he was convicted of material support, not of the more serious conspiracy charge. He was convicted of the material support charges last summer, 2008.
So now talk about what happened to you. So here you were in Towson and you went down to Guantanamo being a base that is on the island of Cuba, the United States, because the Platt Amendment has controlled for many, many years, even though it's on the southern part of
Cuba. That's
very strange. And so you're in what is a tropical paradise, but a prison at the same time, with men who you can communicate with. Talk about that, just your own visceral feelings of going to Guantanamo, even before you met Hamdan and being there in this space.
Well, it's not a tropical paradise. It's on the southern part of Cuba, and it's actually at times a desert. And when we first arrived, there had been a drought for a while, and it really looked like a desert island at that point. It was not Havana. It's not.
Right. You
know, it's not what I expected. Very, very tight security. When we first went down there, we were the first attorneys to go in. And of course, with the military, Charlie Swift is a military attorney, and they didn't know what to make of us. They didn't, know who we were or what we were supposed to be doing. They were very suspicious of us, and it was very difficult. Security was very, very tight getting in and out of there. So it was a very scary place in the very beginning.
So and talk about what happened. Now, Hamdan really was one of the most famous cases coming out of Guantanamo.
He was one of the most famous cases because he was. Charlie said that he was told he was being sent down to cut a deal, and he was
Charlie was sent down to cut a deal with Hamdan.
Right.
So what you're saying? Okay,
right.
Charlie
Swift,
the attorney for the Navy.
That's right. That wasn't Charlie's intention at all, but that's what the military seemingly understood he was going to go do. I think they saw Hamdan as an easy case, that he was kind of a test case. You know, maybe they wanted to use him for material witness or something like this. But Charlie Swift and the other defense attorneys saw him as a perfect test case. Here was a guy who seemingly, didn't do anything, and certainly nothing you could call at that time a war crime. He's being charged as a war criminal. He was selected by the president, one of six initially, two of which were British, and the British fought and eventually got their citizens out. That's Begg and Abbasi. The other four, the defense attorneys put together a very stiff opposition. And in Bush 1, it said that they were subject to these courts alone. They had recourse to no other court in the world. They could only have recourse to this court here. And Charlie directly disobeyed that and went to the Ninth Circuit in Seattle and filed a suit there, which eventually went up to the Supreme Court.
And then?
Won.
Right.
I mean, basically, the Supreme Court said, yes, what he's charged with is not a war crime, that these courts are unconstitutional based on the secret evidence, and that the president didn't have the right to do this.
So here you are in Guantanamo, and Salim Ahmed Hamdan, who is the driver of the bin Laden, is being held by the Americans in Guantanamo. He's in court. The trial ends, and and he gets he doesn't get convicted of the most serious crimes, but he's convicted of a lesser crime in 5 years, which he spent. He was sent back to Yemen to finish out his term, and now he's a free man.
That's right.
So talk about Hamdan. I mean, it's kind of personal. Who was he? Talk a bit about the man that we don't get to hear much about.
Yeah. He was a Yemeni from southern Yemen, from the Hadramaut region, an orphan. He lost his father, I believe, when he was 11. He was then a street kid for a while in McCullough in the south. When the north and south came together, the south was a communist state. He was born into a communist state. And then in 1990, the two Yemens united, and a lot of people, actually in 88, the border opened up. And in 90, he went to Sana'a, the northern capital. And there he was, you know, sort of half on the street, working as a driver, they have these small little bus things they call, Dabab, they call Fly, that runs these little routes. They take six passengers, and he would run those things, and he'd accumulate a little money, and then, you know, he would just sit on the street. He didn't have a whole lot of ambition and wasn't doing much at all. He has like a fourth grade education. He's intelligent. I mean, he's a survivor. There's no doubt about that. And he's sharp in the sense that he has a good sense of what people are about and how to survive amongst people, clearly. But he's not formally educated. And, you know, as all Yemenis are, he's extremely polite and deferential. He had a very difficult time when he realized that, you know, the people that he was working with on the defense were all very well educated and had high positions. And this bothered him a lot. You know, he felt almost embarrassed before all of these people. You know, he's not an ideological person at all. He wasn't someone who was there. He basically was there as employment, you know, making a living. He could make a far better living then. As, you know, came out in trial a number of times, he tried to get out of Afghanistan back to Yemen and get set up, but couldn't quite do it.
So what's the story? How did a person who's not necessarily a jihadist, as we understand the term in America, who is a Yemeni, how did he get involved with Osama bin Laden? How did he end up in Afghanistan?
He was initially recruited by a group who were jihadists, a group that were going to Tajikistan through Afghanistan.
One of the former Soviet republics north of Afghanistan.
Just across the border, yeah.
Right.
And they... You know, got together as kind of an ad hoc group of guys, but people who had fought in Chechnya and people that had fought in Bosnia and Somalia and whatnot, and they were going to, you know, help the oppressed Muslims in Tajikistan. As they went up there, I think, as far as we can tell, it became clear to that group that Hamdan was not a fighting man, but was, you know, a driver. And that became his role in that group as well. They did not get into Tajikistan. The Russians, there had been a settlement. I guess they weren't reading the news, but there had been a settlement. And Russian troops had come in to enforce a peace. And so they couldn't get across the border into Tajikistan. And so they fell back into Afghanistan. And that was just about the time when bin Laden showed up. He was first in Jalalabad and then in Kandahar, and the Taliban had yet to come through. This was pre-Taliban. I mean, Taliban were starting in the south, but they hadn't reached this area yet. A number in this group joined up with bin Laden, and some of them suggested to Hamdan, you know, why don't you ask for a job? You know, why don't you get a job? And they said, well, you know, you can drive for the sheikh. And he said, I'll drive for the sheikh. And he did. And he started driving, you know, bringing agricultural workers to a farm that bin Laden had. Bin Laden had many sort of businesses and whatnot as well. And he started sort of driving agricultural workers and working a little bit on the farm. He was driving a water truck as well, I think. And he was doing what, you know.
He was working stiff, working for Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, yeah, working for the enterprise, you know.
Right.
Eventually, he's pulled into the motor pool. where he's part of the caravan. He purchases cars, he works on cars, and he goes out on the caravan when Bin Laden is being moved around and whatnot.
And then he's picked up by the Americans after 9/11 in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And brought to Guantanamo Bay.
Held for a while in Afghanistan and then brought to Guantanamo, yes.
We're talking a moment with Chuck Schmitz. Chuck Schmitz is associate professor of geography at Towson University, the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. He ended up being the Arabic translator and cultural interpreter for Hamdan, a Yemeni held at Guantanamo, one of the most famous cases in all of this. And he's in this month's Urbanite magazine, an article called Lost in Translation. And this is one of our Urbanite radio stories here that we bring to you on the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA. We only have about 10 minutes or so left, so join us here at 410-319-8888 if you have some questions and comments for Chuck Schmidt as we talk about his work in Guantanamo with Hamdan, who is now back in Yemen.
That's right. He's a free man in Yemen right now.
He's a free man in Yemen right now. Now, he, of course, the media didn't trust you or the men around you when he first met you.
That's right. I mean, this is the... I think this is the interesting story. His comment was at one point, Charlie asked him, you know.
Charlie Swift, who was
Charlie
the commander who was defending him in court.
Right. He says, I mean, why trust us? And his comment was, a drowning man at sea will grab at any outstretched hand. Much later, we revisited this idea, and you know, I or someone else suggested to me, I mean, this could be an elaborate interrogation ruse. I mean, the place was an interrogation center, and you know, by design, they make it so you don't know your head from your foot, as he would say, and you know, it could be a very elaborate deception, and you know, that was at the back of his mind. And I'll give you an example. A lot of what I did was to. To be a teacher was to educate on both sides, actually. And one of the things that was very difficult for Hamdan was to understand the difference between the judge ruling that he was an unlawful enemy combatant, therefore subject to the jurisdiction of that court, and being a neutral interpreter of law before the jury. Hamdan saw that the judge had ruled against him in his eyes and then thought the whole trial, therefore, must be biased.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had to talk about standards of evidence because the standard of evidence was much lower for the determination of jurisdiction than it is for, you know, conviction before a jury, blah, blah, blah. But this, he never believed it, I don't think, until the end, until he saw what actually happened, you know. And so I think there was doubts the whole way through.
But he ended up trusting you and
to some extent. I don't think he entirely. No, I don't.
Even to this day.
Oh yeah. I'm sure that there's part of him that kind of goes, you know, we got through that in spite of those guys, you know.
In spite of those guys.
Yeah.
So. But now, what about all the things I've read about the possibility that you are going to do a book with Hamdan about his struggles in life in Yemen? Is that just a lot of hype?
No, I would love to. I think, you know, there is a book out by Jonathan Mahler about the early part of the case up to 2006. And I think there are other people who are working on, you know, the whole story. But I think a story that has yet to be told is Hamdan's story. And I talked to him about it. I said, you know, let's do a book together. You know, we can work it together. And his attitude is, well, why would anybody be interested?
Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
world would be interested in this book.
He has no idea. He has no idea how famous he is or how...
Really?
No, he has no idea. When first went in there, Charlie Swift told him, you're going to be famous. And he said, I don't want to be famous. I just want to get out of here.
Get me out of Guantanamo.
Swift said, in order to get out of here, you got to be famous. He really does not understand why the world is paying attention to him.
So what would be fascinating is, and what you can do here, and the next time we get together to explore this, is that Hamdan, Salim Ahmed Hamdan, the driver for Osama bin Laden, who is now a free man in Yemen, I mean, the idea of what a normal, everyday, working Arab man, a Yemeni man, how he gets involved in this jihadist world, what his life is like. This is just a, he's no, that's what made me crazy about the whole Bush thing in some ways, with locking people up and calling them the not real combatants, is that these are no different than any other working civilian who would end up in somebody's army.
Yes.
Foot soldiers in the world.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's right. And that was the point of the defense. The defense very much wanted, well, the defense attacked the venue. Of course, they said, you know, we can't tell truth at this venue because this is not a fair venue. But another big part of it was to sort of distinguish between the types of people, what is a war crime, and what are the types of people and the responsibilities involved. And that's what Hamdan was perfect for because, mm-hmm. you know, what the FBI would say, they were confounded by him because they said, how could someone be so close? There are lots of pictures of Hamdan standing next to bin Laden. How could someone be so close and not know what was going on, not be involved?
It's the difference between being a concentration camp guard and somebody who might have been Himmler or Hitler's chauffeur in a job or driving a truck in a caravan for the Nazi army.
Not even, I don't think. Because you don't see, I mean, he saw training camps, but a training camp is conventional warfare for the most part. I mean, most of what bin Laden was doing in those training camps, of course, there were the, you know, the side terrorist activities.
Right.
But those, of course, were kept secret. The main activity was training conventional fighters for the Northern Alliance. And those are not war criminals. Those are fighting a conventional civil war, right? The activities of the military committee, of course, the special operations, of course no one's going to know about that.
Well, I'm just really fascinated by this, by the entire story. And when we read this in the Urbanite, we knew this was going to be one of our stories for the month for the Urbanite, which is what we've done here, our Urbanite radio stories. We've been talking to Chuck Schmitz, a professor of geography at Tufts University and president of the American Institute for Yemeni Studies. The article is called Lost in Translation in this month's March issue of the Urbanite. And he was the interpreter for Salim Ahmed Hamdan, a prisoner at Guantanamo who was set free. Fascinating story, and we're going to come back to Chuck for a much longer conversation in the very near future. It's a pleasure to have you know that you're in Baltimore and that we have such interesting people living in our community who have done such interesting things. Chuck, it's been great to have you here.
Thank you, Mark. I enjoyed being here.
So this is part of our Urbanite Radio Story series, and we go up to the Urbanite, read the article, and see more. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they are still there to help people during difficult times. For more information, go to MECU.com. Stay with us. When we come back from this very brief break, you'll hear our conversation with public radio host Tavis Smiley. Don't go away. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information on personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Right now, we're about to hear a conversation with Tavis Smiley. You know, he's the host of the Tavis Smiley Show, which is distributed by Public Radio International, and host of Tavis Smiley, a late-night talk show aired on PBS. 10 years ago, he launched a yearly event called The State of the Black Union. Takes place every February, features black politicians, artists, writers, and thinkers reflecting on the state of conditions for African Americans in America and where forward movement needs to be made. He's the author of several books, including The Covenant with Black America, How to Make Black America Better, Leading African Americans Speak Out, and his latest book is Accountable, Making America as Good as Its Promise. He'll be appearing at the Enoch Pratt Free Library tomorrow at 6:30 to discuss this book. I'll be emceeing, and he joined me earlier today for a conversation, and we began to look at the industry we both work in, public broadcasting. We've been watching what happens in the public media in this country, and you've been on public media for a long time and have built your own world there. And I would just like to get your comment on your thoughts on public media and race. It seems to me that in many ways that our public media that we're both part of is one of the most self-segregating media I know in America.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have Michelle Martin, and she is looked at sometimes as a black talk show host as opposed to being as good as Terry Gross or Diane Reamer, if not better, at what she does. And you, as another example. I mean, your show ranges all over the place. It's not a black talk show. It's a show moderated by somebody who's African-American. But the mindset in public media seems to be to segregate our program. Am I misreading this?
No, you're not misreading it at all. I, as you know, was the first person in the history of NPR. After NPR had been around for almost 34 years, there had never been an African-American who hosted his own signature talk show. You recall when I started with NPR in 2002, I was the first African-American to ever do that. And so I know something of this journey. And Michelle Martin and other shows and other hosts, quite frankly, came on. Michelle Norris came on to NPR after I was there. Michelle Martin came on after I was there. So there are a number of persons who had, Farai Chidea had an opportunity. Ed Gordon had an opportunity. So there are a number of persons who came on after I started as the first African-American back in 2002. I was troubled then, Mark, that it took until 2002, again, almost 34 years of NPR's existence. And by the way, as you know, all of our taxpayer dollars go to support public radio and public television.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't understand why it had taken so long for me to be the first person to arrive in 2002. After 3 years of being on NPR or being distributed by them, I had some issues about, how might I put it, their lack of aggression where diversity and inclusion was concerned. And I didn't want to cast aspersion on NPR. I thought then, and I think now, that NPR is as good as it gets in terms of delivering news, empowering people around the world with information that can help them live better lives. And that's why I'm still on public radio, because I love public radio. That said, there is work to be done around issues of diversity and inclusion. And so when you have too many people making decisions in public radio that don't understand that, don't appreciate that, and don't embrace that, it just takes too long for that to happen. The short answer is this. Public radio's programming ought to be diverse in and of itself. It ought not to require a black program here, a Hispanic program over here, a womanist program over here. All of these themes ought to be a part of the programming of public radio. But because that is not the case, because of the persons who are making decisions who don't embrace this agenda, then we have to go outside of the box, so to speak, to have a black show here or there. Here's the irony, and I'll be done with this. The irony for me, Mark, is that everybody, I mean, public radio, as you know, is supposed to be, it certainly gets chided as being part of the liberal media establishment. Nobody would ever refer to public radio, NPR, as part of the conservative citadel in this country. Everybody bashes NPR for being liberal radio, and we know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe that, but that's the way it gets bashed. My point is this, that the folk who run NPR, the folk who run public radio, pardon my English, ain't that liberal because we, again, don't have enough diversity and inclusion on the air. And here's the rub for me, that everybody in this universe is celebrating the first black president, Barack Obama. How is it that we celebrate the first black president, but we haven't gotten around to understanding, appreciating, or embracing that same level of inclusion, that same level of diversity, and appreciation thereof has to move beyond the Oval Office to every sphere of influence, every human endeavor in this country? My point is, we can't just celebrate it in the White House, Mark, and not celebrate it in other places.
If you can't tell by the voice already, we're talking with Tavis Smiley. His latest work, Accountable, Making America as Good as Its Promise. The Black State of the Union that he hosts took place last weekend. He's now on a 10-city accountability tour. And tomorrow evening, he will be at the Enoch Pratt Free Library from 6:30 to 8:30. And you can call 410-396-5430 for more information. I will be there as well, emceeing that evening with Tavis Smiley. Look forward to all of you joining us for that conversation. And Tavis, when we talk about making America accountable, and let me just stick with public media for a moment and then mm-hmm. move on. I mean, the part of the issue I've always had is that we see programs like News and Notes and others that are created, and it's important to have programming that speaks to black America.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about that. It's a segregated country, history of racism, slavery, all the rest. It's important to have that programming. However, the question is, what does it take
to create a truly multicultural, multiracial programming on public media. I mean, I think that the takeaway from PRI is attempting that at the moment with Adora Udoji and John Hockenberry. Mm-hmm. But what does it really take? And why is it so difficult to get there?
It takes a sensitivity to the issue. It takes a concern for the matter. It takes people who are making decisions who have lived and who do, in fact, live in communities where these issues matter. It really just takes being open-minded. I mean, this stuff is not rocket science. Let's look at it in the reverse, Mark, and you made this point earlier. Let's look at it in the reverse. As the first African-American to host his own show on public radio starting in 2002, everybody knows that you don't survive on public radio if you just rely on black folk to tune in. The reason why our show was the fastest growing show in the history of NPR, with the youngest demographic of any program on NPR. So it was the fastest growing, it had the youngest demographic, and it was the most celebrated, and we were breaking news stories when I was doing that show live every day. So we weren't just covering news, we were making news and breaking news. NPR hadn't broken as many news stories since Nina Totenberg broke the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill story 10 years before I arrived at NPR. And we were doing that, breaking news regularly. I've been off of NPR. I mean, I'm on public radio stations, but not distributed by NPR. And I look up every other day or so, every other week or so, and I see stories that I did on NPR then that are still being used because I was the last person to have interviewed person X before they died or addressed issue X. I was the person most recently to address it. So I still find from time to time in my press clippings that interviews I did 2 or 3 years ago are still being used on various public radio programs because I was the only person interested at that time in addressing that political issue, whatever it might have been. But here's my point, that we have to get people making decisions who, again, understand, appreciate, and embrace this notion of inclusion in America. And until those kinds of decisions are made around a sensitivity for including everybody, there's a reason, Mark, why we call it broadcast and not narrowcast. Mm-hmm. I believe that it's about introducing public radio at its best, Mark. At its best, public radio allows Americans to be introduced to each other. It allows us to challenge people in love, to reexamine the assumptions they hold, to expand their inventory of ideas. So again, I think public radio at its best can be used to allow us to introduce Americans to each other, but you have to have people who at the outset care about those decisions, have those kinds of sensitivities, and push that kind of agenda. If you don't have people making those kind of decisions, it never happens.
Tavis Mali is with us for this portion of our show. The book we're going to be talking about here in a moment is Accountable, Making America as Good as Its Promise. Tavis Mali will be with us here in Baltimore tomorrow at the Enoch Pratt Free Library from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. You can call 396-5430. That's 410-396-5430. For more information, I will be there emceeing the evening with Tavis and looking forward to you joining us there with Tavis Mali tomorrow at Enoch Pratt Free Library. The interesting place I think we are in, on whether it's your show, the book you've written, this latest book, Accountable, where we are is that we have a black president in the United States of America, and there's something going on here where conversation is beginning, and as most people who look at history would think, it's coming out of the black world, speaking to the rest of America about the kind of nation we need to be. It's a very special relationship now that has never happened before. Not in this kind of powerful way, I think. And you're at the heart of that in the media.
I appreciate that, number one. But I see this as the continuing love and service of black people to the country. Black people, I believe, have always been the conscience of this country. African Americans have always been the conscience of this country. At our best, black people have helped make America the nation that she is. And so this book, Accountable, and the trilogy of books that we've put out trying to make America a nation as good as its promise really harkens back to my hero, the greatest American I think we've ever produced, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who, along with others, pushed America into her greatness. Black folk have learned to love this country. We have learned over the years, over the centuries, to love this country, oftentimes, Mark, not because of, but in spite of. But a true patriot, I believe, is one who loves his or her country and rebukes as opposed to excusing its sins. And so you have to push your country into its greatness. You have to push your president into his greatness. And so what this book Accountable is about, and the conversation that we're trying to build around it, it's ultimately about this, Mark. I want Barack Obama not just to be celebrated for symbolism. I want him to be celebrated for substance. I want Barack Obama to be a great president. I believe he can be a great president, but only, Mark, if we help make him a great president. Great presidents, I keep saying, aren't born. Great presidents are made. For all the comparisons between Lincoln and Obama, there is no Abraham Lincoln if there is no Frederick Douglass. Somebody, Mark, has got to play the role of Frederick Douglass to push him, to escort him, to thrust him into his greatness. I don't want to look up 4 years from now and not have much to celebrate because we got stuck on the symbolism again and never got around to the substance. So how do we help make him a great president? We do that by holding him accountable to doing the things he said he wanted to do. So this book does two things, essentially. It lays out, Mark, in detail what Obama promised to do as a candidate. On the issues that we raised in the first book, The Covenant, the first book was the what, I like to say. Mm-hmm. What was the agenda? You and I talked about that when that book came out some years ago. Mm-hmm. What is the agenda? These top 10 issues that we have got to grapple with if we're going to make America a better nation. We laid out the what in the first book, The Covenant. The second book, The Covenant in Action, as the title suggests, was the how. How to take that agenda and put it into action. Accountable, now, the third and final book in this trilogy, is the whether. It is the yardstick for whether or not we are making the kind of progress we ought to be making. I believe, Mark, that this moment is truly pregnant with possibility. I believe that this country could really be on the precipice of something great, although it looks like all hell is breaking loose. The bottom line is that we have to hold President Obama and all of our leaders accountable to the promises they made. Again, promises made ought to be promises kept. So in the book, we lay out all the things he said he wanted to do as a candidate on these 10 issues in these chapters. And right along with that, Mark, and equally as important, we lay out what we can do as everyday people to help get that agenda through. It is still the case that in America, the most important role, the most important person is the one who plays the role of citizen, and we cannot surrender our power if we're going to maximize this moment. Their accountability, Mark, is our responsibility, and that's what this book and this tour is all about, how we hold them accountable and maximize what this moment portends for our nation.
We're talking with Tavis Smiley. We're talking about accountable, making America as good as its promise. He's now on a 10-city accountability tour. He'll be here tomorrow at the Enoch Pratt Library at 6:30. You can join us there for that and listen to this conversation now here on WEAA. Part of how you do this in the book is talking about different people, about mm-hmm. people like Ryan Matthews and people like George Mitchell and the woman whose name I'm blocking on, but will come to me in 2 seconds, who caught breast cancer after fighting so hard to save her community.
Mm-hmm.
Making it personal.
Yeah.
These are policy issues, but they're wrapped around in our lives.
Every chapter in the book, Mark, as you duly note, starts with narratives, personal narratives, the stories of everyday Americans, just like you and me and all the persons listening, who oftentimes, through no fault of their own, found themselves in harm's way. And the book lays out every chapter, again, starts with these narratives so that we can see ourselves in this situation, number one. I believe that when you connect to the humanity of other people, you understand public policy issues in a different way. So the chapters start out by allowing us to understand, appreciate, embrace, to connect to the humanity of everyday people like ourselves. And in so doing, I think we can, again, make some progress. I think of the story right quick. Let me tell this one of Diamante Driver.
Yes, right.
In the healthcare chapter, the first chapter in the book, there's a story, true story. All these stories are true, of course, of a 12-year-old kid named Diamante Driver who wakes up one morning with a really bad toothache. The toothache, over a period of time, turns into a tooth abscess. The tooth abscess ends up getting infected in this 12-year-old boy's mouth. He starts with a toothache. It turns to a tooth abscess. The abscess gets infected. The infection spreads from his tooth to his brain. At this point, we have to rush 12-year-old Diamante to the hospital to try to save his life. We end up spending over $250,000 of taxpayer money, over $250,000 of taxpayer money to try to save Diamante's life because his mother could not afford an $89 extraction of that tooth. And because she couldn't afford it, Diamante, at 12 years old, dies. Here's the rub on that story beyond his death, which is bad enough. His mother wasn't lazy. His mother wasn't on welfare. Mm-hmm. His mother wasn't, you know, refusing to look for a job. His mother was working. What is it with this term, Mark, that we've come to accept? It just rolls off our lips with ease, this notion of the working poor. What is that? That ought to be oxymoronic. If you work, you ought not to be poor. It ought not to be a minimum wage. It ought to be about a living wage. Nobody who works ought to be poor, and nobody who works in this country ought to not have access to some high quality or even basic fundamental health care. And it is tragic that a 12-year-old boy dies over a toothache because his mama couldn't afford an $89 extraction because she didn't have health insurance, even though she worked. If you can't connect to the humanity in that story, then I can't help you. But every chapter, health, education, the environment, these stories allow us to connect to the humanity of our fellow citizens. And then we understand why Barack Obama has got to be aided and abetted in pushing an agenda through that makes America a nation that's closer to its promise for all of us. Here's the quick read on this. There's still a gap in this country, Mark, between the promise of America and the possibility in America. The promise of America is one thing, but the actual possibility in America for each and every one of us is something different, and we got to shrink that gap. That's what Accountable is all about.
And the story you tell about Diamante Driver is a Maryland story. I mean,
absolutely.
It happened in Prince George's County.
Right down the street.
And I remember when that happened very well. And the question is, how do we change? So let's take about the policy issues around health for a moment. Then we'll try to get a couple more before you have to go, and we have to let you go off to your next meeting. But the issue going on now in healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
President Barack Obama is having a meeting at the White House with many people about the future of healthcare. In 2003, Barack Obama said that the only, and whether you agree with this or not, is not the issue politically or ideologically, but Barack Obama said that single-payer health care was the only way America was going to cover the health care of all of our people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of a sudden, anybody who's speaking about single-payer is not at the table in this meeting. Not one person. The insurance companies are there. The hospitals are there. Everyone is there except for the people who are saying there's a different way for us to do it.
And this is the president who, you recall, during the campaign, kept saying that he wanted to have these health meetings live on C-SPAN. Remember that?
Yes.
He said he's going to televise these meetings on C-SPAN,
right,
and that everybody was going to be at the table. See, you're making the point now. You have to hold leaders accountable to what they said they were going to do when they ran. If you don't hold them accountable, this is precisely what happens. So back to your question then, what do we do? One, we inform ourselves, as this book does, of what he said he was going to do. Number two, if the president and other leaders, it's not just about him, I repeat, if they don't do what they said they were going to do that made us vote for them, support them, contribute to them, campaign for them in the first place, then they need to be reminded of that, number two. Number three, this moment, again, I said earlier, is pregnant with possibility. I believe that during this administration, we can make some progress on universal health care or some basic fundamental health care for every American in this country. But that, to your brilliant point, Mark, is not going to happen unless the masses of everyday people rise up, because you're right. All those powers that be who are seated around the table, they're the ones who wield the influence. They have the money. They make the contributions. They run this town called Washington, D.C. And it's only going to be if everyday people, the Diamante Drivers of the world, the parents of the Diamante Drivers of the world, those of us who are disenfranchised politically, socially, economically, and culturally, unless the masses of people rise up and say now is the time, rally behind the president to do what he said he was going to do, to not leave us out of the process, to make sure that all voices are heard, that everybody's at the table, unless that happens, this thing is going to end up running off the tracks. But that's, again, why a book like Accountable is so important. I don't need to wait 100 days in from Mark to tell me how the president did, with all due respect to Mark, who I love and trust, or CNN or ABC, CBS, NBC, or anybody else. Why do I have to wait 100 days? If everybody who ran said they wanted to start governing on day one, then you start being held accountable on day one. And that's what this book allows us to do. Now, there are certain things Obama promised to do on certain issues, Mark, in this book that he's already done. So there's certain things in my personal copy that I've already checked off. Mm-hmm. But clearly there's so much more to do. This, again, is not about aspersion. It's about accountability. And that's why I think this conversation, these town hall meetings, this text, this moment is so important for us to maximize.
And what's the response you're getting from those in power with this? I mean, I know that there was some critical moments during the election when Barack Obama did not come to the Black State of the Union last year during mm-hmm. the campaign. That caused tension. It was very clear. Mm-hmm. It was out there. And you were not one of those who, in the African-American world of media, who jumped on the bandwagon. Mm-hmm. You took your own critical step back to say, I'm covering this. I'm not going to leap into anybody's bandwagon.
Right.
So how has all that played out in this?
It's played out okay. I mean, sometimes it takes people a while to catch up. I was talking about accountability last year, and now in every speech, as I intimated earlier, in every speech the president gives, now what's he talking about, Mark? Accountability. In every speech he gives, he's saying, hold me accountable. Accountable is the word now. The president wants to be held accountable. Nancy Pelosi, the Democrats in the House are saying, hold me accountable. Reid is saying accountability in the Senate. We want accountability for Wall Street. We want accountability for the auto industry. Accountability for ourselves. The word right now, accountable, is the word. That is the, I think accountable is the word for 2009. It is the word of the year. Everybody now talking about accountability, which I, with humility, was talking about a year ago. The president did not make it to the State of the Black Union last year, but this year, just a week ago, last Saturday, not even a week ago now, the president joined us via satellite from the White House, started out at that gathering by saying thank you to me, which I appreciated, but then went on to talk about what else? Accountability.
Accountability.
So a year later, he showed up to be a part of that conversation talking about the same thing that I was talking about a year ago. And so, again, sometimes it takes folk a while to catch up and to understand that you weren't, again, trying to cast aspersion. You were talking about accountability for the sole purpose of having an agenda that we could all understand, that we could all embrace, that we could all debate for that matter, but an agenda that would be about moving this country forward, including African Americans. And so a year later, I mean, I think things have worked out given how well the book is being received, how well the tour is going. But at the end of the day, I want us to get to a place in this country, Mark, where we again don't start talking about accountability when they come back for re-election, but start talking about accountability the minute they go into office.
And by the woman I was trying to remember, whose name I could not remember, was Sheila Holt Orsted.
Absolutely.
In your chapter on environmental justice for all.
Yeah, it's a powerful story.
It was a very powerful story.
Yeah.
Let's talk a bit about the how here before we run out of time. And mm-hmm. by that I mean whether you look at history and whether it was Abraham Lincoln and the abolitionists and Frederick Douglass pushing him, or whether it was Lyndon Baines Johnson and Martin Luther King and
That's
the
right.
others in the struggle pushing him.
That's right.
That presidents have to be pushed, as you talked earlier. So let's talk about this agenda of accountability and what you perceive has to be done by the citizens of America to push this administration.
Three things. Number one, we have to inform ourselves, and that's why the work has already been done. I have a lot of friends, Mark, as you know, in the media, you and I both do, and all of my media friends are loving me right about now because I've done their homework for them. they don't have to do any research now on what he said about these issues. All the research is done. It's in a book. So one, we have to inform ourselves about what he said. Number two, we have to decide for ourselves what role we want to play in the process of helping him to push that agenda through. Three, we have to stay diligent. We got to stay vigilant. We have to stay awake. We have to stay aware. We've discussed two or three examples in this conversation of things that Mr. Obama said that we see some slight shifts. What was the word we used during the campaign? Pivot.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, that was the word of the campaign?
Mm-hmm.
Pivoting. We don't want to see a bunch of pivoting. But it is true that campaigning is one thing, governing is something else. And the minute you start governing, no matter who you are, you start disappointing. So we got to inform ourselves. We got to figure out the role we want to play in this process. We have to stay aware and awake to make sure that they're doing, all of these leaders, what they said they were going to do. That's why the checklist in the book are so important. That's why the framework for assessment in the book is so important. That's why the report card in the back of the book is so important. That's why this conversation, quite frankly, is so important. Because if we don't stay on our P's and our Q's, if we don't make them cross the T's and dot the I's, then we're going to look up again 4 years from now and not have as much to celebrate as I think we could have. Again, I think there's so much that could come out of this moment, but it will only happen if we understand again that their accountability is our responsibility.
Now, one last thing, Tavis, before you go, and this is not in the book, but you have commented on it. It's been on the Sunday talk shows that you've been a real presence on lately. Congratulations for that. Is Michael Steele, who's a Marylander.
Oh, yeah.
Ran a lieutenant governor, now head of the Republican Party. And this whole brouhaha around Steele as the new quote, African-American leader of the Republican Party and his battle with Rush Limbaugh and the rest, and your take on all that?
Pretty simply this. First of all, 10 years ago, we started these State of the Black Union conversations. I could never have imagined, Mark, we'd have an African-American president, much less a head of the Republican committee,
right.
Who's an African-American. So I think that is something to celebrate, that the titular head of the Democratic Party, Mr. Obama, and the actual head of the RNC, Michael Steele, both African-American men. That's something I think that we ought to revel in. I think that Mr. Steele's challenge is to be the loyal opposition to the Democratic Party, not to be obstructionist as his party was during the stimulus debate, not to be partisan as they were during the stimulus debate, but loyal opposition, not obstructionist. And they got to be careful about where that line is. With regard to Rush Limbaugh, I think Michael Steele, quite frankly, and I said so already publicly, I think he made a mistake in challenging Rush Limbaugh in the way that he did. That's not to suggest that Rush Limbaugh ought not to be challenged. I do it all the time. And he does the same thing with me when we disagree. But I think he made a few mistakes. Number one, you can't allow Rush Limbaugh, who is an entertainer, to distract you. He's a provocative entertainer, and he's much more than that. People certainly, I think, sadly, take their news cues from him. People listen to him and make their public policy decisions or how they feel about political issues by listening to Rush Limbaugh. I think that's dangerous, but that's my own assessment here. But you can't allow him to distract you from the work that you ought to be doing as chairman of the party. That's number one. Point number two, this brouhaha, I think, underscores how lost the Republican Party is. They don't know who they are. They don't know who their leader is. They don't know where they're headed. It's embarrassing. It ought to be embarrassing to every Republican in the country that this sort of infighting is taking place, because, again, it just underscores how out of control they are. They have spun out of control. How they get back on track for the midterm elections, much less for 4 years from now, I don't know. But it ain't going to happen like this. Pardon my English. Thirdly and finally, and you know this well as a talk show host, here's the part that killed me the most. Michael Steele, in a battle with Rush Limbaugh, will simply and fundamentally and lastly never have the last word. You never have the last word with Rush Limbaugh. You know why? Because he has a microphone every day. So what is the point in getting into it with Rush Limbaugh when he's going to wear you out every single day? And the reason why he had to turn around Mr. Steele, that is, and apologize so quickly, is because he had his behind handed back to him by that conservative base of his party that Limbaugh talks to every day. It was just strategic. And Michael Steele is a very smart guy, and I like him. He was on our panel last weekend at the State of the Black Union Symposium. And strategically, he's usually much better than that. I think he learned his lesson. He apologized. He did the right thing. He moved on. But you never get into a tit for tat with a talk show host who's got 30, 40 million people listening to him all the time, preaching to the choir, and he's got the microphone. Strategically, it just didn't make any sense to me.
We've been talking with Tavis Smiley, public radio and public television talk show figure, who is a political commentator, entrepreneur, and a personality that we all know. His latest book we've been talking about is Accountable, Making America as Good as Its Promise. The Black State of the Union took place last weekend that he hosted. He's now on a 10-city accountability tour. And we'll be speaking tomorrow evening at the Enoch Pratt Free Library from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. I'll be emceeing, and you can join us all there with Tavis Smiley. Just call 410-396-5433. 630 for more information, or just join us downtown on Cathedral Street at 630 to hear Tavis Smiley. And Tavis, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Mark, nice to be on with you. And I should mention right quickly that United Healthcare is sponsoring this tour. And tomorrow, along with the conversation that I'm so delighted to be a part of with you, there'll be free health screenings, because we were talking about health in this conversation. I never want to leave out the fact that on this tour, we're doing free health screenings. So come on down, get your free screenings, get a good seat, get your book, and come see this brilliant interviewer, Mark.
Thank you so much, Tavis. Take care.
Thank you, sir.
Tavis Smiley tomorrow night in our Pratt Library at 6:30. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media, and our producers are Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman at WEAA. Thanks to Nick Shostrom for engineering the Tavis Smiley interview. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, and Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. And to hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.